It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a Wisconsin sports writer shares the latest news on the Brewers' quest for the playoffs and the big trades they made to get ready for the home stretch. First, throughout his presidential campaign and his time in the White House, President Trump has repeatedly attacked the media and has called members of the press the enemy of the people. That was a phrase that took on a new life this week after the president's daughter, Ivanka Trump, was asked about whether or not she agreed with her father's assessment.
I have some sensitivity around why people have concerns and gripe, especially when they're sort of feel targeted. But no, I do not feel that the media is the enemy of the people.
The White House was given a chance to distance itself from the president's comments, something that Press Secretary Sarah Sanders didn't do. All this comes during a week where the president seemed to up his attacks against members of the media, calling them horrible, horrendous people and fake, disgusting news during a campaign rally. Amy Parnes joins us now to look at the ongoing feud between the president and the press. She's a senior political correspondent at The Hill, where she recently wrote the piece, Trump Takes Us Versus Them Media War to New Heights. Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, this has been going on, as you write, through the campaign, into the Trump presidency. Are things going to a new level in some ways just over this last week or two?
I think so. And in talking to my colleagues in the White House press corps, they feel that way, too. I mean, a lot of people feel that palpable sense of hostility. They're nervous at covering these rallies. A lot of them have to show up alone, go to walk in parking lots at the end of the rally, and they're worried. You know, the crowds have turned on them. My colleague Jim Acosta has had people shout obscenities at him during these rallies. So I think that's really disconcerting to a lot of people, and they do feel like it has gone beyond the pale.
And yet there is, in some ways, is a symbiotic relationship here. Candidate and then President Trump reaches out to his followers in some ways by attacking the media. The media, through the campaign, got pretty good ratings by covering these remarks.
That's the thing, is that you look at any one of the networks, and it's basically all 24/7 President Trump at this point. And so I think the networks, the cable networks in particular, have benefited from this because there is so much thirst for what's happening, and the news is unraveling very quickly, particularly with the Russia investigation and so much focused on the White House and their dealings. And so I think that there is a tremendous amount of attention being paid to the White House, and so a lot of these cable networks and media outlets are benefiting from it.
I was looking at charts of trust in the media over the years, in the last couple decades, and you see Democrats and independents holding steady, maybe inching up a little bit for Democrats, Republicans slowly declining, and then really dropping, especially under the Trump campaign. There's a definite partisan divide when it comes to the mainstream media, isn't there?
Definitely. And what's happened, I think, increasingly, and when I talk to people for the story, they kind of confirm this, but, people are in their own silos, and they're tuning into, if you're a Republican, you tune into Fox News. If you're a Democrat, you'll tune into MSNBC or CNN. And so you're constantly hearing kind of what you want to hear, but you're not listening to the other side, and you're not, you're not letting the other side convince you or have a conversation about what's happening. So everyone feels they're in the right, and it's, I think it's getting increasingly worse.
You mentioned Jim Acosta at a press briefing yesterday. The CNN reporter Jim Acosta asked Press Secretary Sarah Sanders to denounce the claim that journalists are the enemy of the people, just to say that they're not. Here's a little bit of what she had to say.
It's ironic, Jim, that not only you and the media attack the president for his rhetoric when they frequently lower the level of conversation in this country. Repeatedly, the media resorts to personal attacks without any content other than to incite anger.
Sanders talked about times when she felt personally attacked by the media. She ultimately did not say that. She said the president's statements, his opinion is clear on this. This was an uncomfortable exchange to watch at a White House press briefing. What did you make of that?
It was particularly uncomfortable, and I think it had been building to this moment. The crowd had turned on Jim a couple of days earlier, and there was all this you know, buzz about what's happening at rallies and if they were getting worse, and a lot of people felt that. And so I think, you know, and this all also comes on the heels of a couple months after the White House Correspondents' Dinner and how Sarah Sanders felt like she was being treated unfairly. So you had these two sort of duke it out. But I think it was a pretty fair question, especially in that Ivanka Trump kind of raised it yesterday in an interview and said that she doesn't believe the press is the enemy of the people. And so I think, you know, it was a fair question to ask President Trump's press secretary to see if she actually agreed with that, too. Of course, she says, you know, she's up there speaking for the press, for the president, rather. And so she was sort of defending his stance. But it was a very interesting moment, particularly when he walked out. And, you know, a lot of people just didn't agree with that and thought it was really rather offensive.
And responding to Ivanka Trump's comments, the president said in a tweet, quoting, "They asked my daughter Ivanka whether or not the media is the enemy of the people. She correctly said no. It is the fake news," all caps there, "which is a large percentage of the media that is the enemy of the people." So talk about the use of fake news.
Well, yeah, and, you know, you hear him constantly. It took him, I think, 6 minutes in his rally yesterday to kind of talk about not the issues, but the fake news in the back of the room, and he points them out, and he singles them out, and he's done this since the campaign. You know, you'll recall little Katie Turr from MSNBC. He kind of very much personalizes not just the news organization, but the actual people who represent the organization. So I think he sort of, and he does this, I think, because he knows that it kind of rallies his base. It's sort of a dog whistle to get everyone kind of excited, and, you know, and it's worked for him. I think a lot of people I spoke to agree with that. They think that this has been an effective strategy for him. It's one that would never work for anyone else, but for some reason he's able to employ it.
Talking to Amy Parnes, senior political correspondent at The Hill, about the latest between Donald Trump, candidate Donald Trump, now President Donald Trump, and the media. Amy, in some ways, people might think, well, it's good to have an adversarial relationship, say, between the White House press corps and the White House they're covering. But talk about the role of that press corps, the press in general, when they're not just covering things, they're also the object of the story of these attacks.
Yeah, I think it's a completely normal relationship. You know, I covered the Obama administration for almost his full time as president, and it's perfectly normal. And of course, every White House is going to take issue with stories and with certain reports that media outlets put out. But, you know, I think it's gone to a whole new level with this administration. And I talked to people about that. I said, you know, when do you think it actually worsened? And one Democratic strategist points out that, you know, while the Obama administration had its sticky points, she pointed to Trayvon Martin, for example, and how that was a division point for many people, how it kind of has worsened because the president will kind of bypass the press and go on Twitter and say these things and go into rallies, unlike any other president, and just attack the press full on in front of, you know, hundreds of people. And so I think that's why it's kind of stuck. And I think what people are kind of were hoping was that the president would actually say or tone it down and say, you know, these people are not the enemy of the people. You know, I do believe in free speech. This is kind of a tenet of our country and we should be for this. But he hasn't done that. He's actually escalated it. And so I think that's why it has become such a firestorm and why it's become so problematic as of late.
We've seen Republican U.S. Senator Jeff Flake, who's notably not running for re-election, criticize the president for this, saying, you know, the enemy of the people kind of rhetoric goes back to the Soviet Union, Stalinist Russia. Has there been much other reaction within the Republican Party on this?
No, I think quietly, I think a lot of Republicans sort of roll their eyes at it and think that it's inappropriate. But of course, few are willing to actually go on the record and say as much. And I think that's why it's also heightened that you haven't really had people come out and defend the press and what the press does. And, you know, I think for a lot of my colleagues, for me, it's offensive because we go out there and we, every single day, you know, we're assigned stories. We report those stories. We try to get as close to the truth as possible. And so when you're doing that, when you're trying to be a public service, in essence, it is offensive for the president to kind of take issue at large with what you are trying to do and what most people are trying to do in this profession.
Do you see, you know, we're just a couple months off now from midterm elections. Do you think that we're seeing this ramp up as an election time strategy?
I definitely think so. I mean, I talked about this earlier, but I think that, you know, his base and his supporters really kind of rally around this whole concept of fake news and the media being the enemy of the people. And, you know, you hear the cheers at rallies when he says as much. And I think that's why he is going to continue doing that, because he knows that's what they want to hear. You know, anyone that's not Fox News is sort of the enemy of those supporters, and they believe that. You know, they think that what is being said in news stories and television reports is just, they're just lies. And so I think that it really stimulates his base and gets them activated, and he'll continue to do that. I think, you know, we haven't seen anything yet. The campaign is just really beginning. I think after the midterms, you're going to hear him say it basically every day.
We'll leave it there for now. Thanks to Amy Parnes, senior political correspondent at The Hill. Now, after a surprisingly competitive 2017, the Milwaukee Brewers again find themselves in a push for the playoffs with about 2 months to go in the season. In an effort to strengthen their roster for the home stretch, the team made several moves ahead of the July 31st non-waiver trade deadline. Tom Hodricourt is the Brewers beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I talked to him yesterday before the Brewers 21-5 loss last night in Los Angeles. Tom, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. How are you today?
Pretty good. Well, before we dive into the trades, let's set the scene. The Brewers, they're in a tight race, right, for first place right now.
They are. They've been going back and forth, jockeying with the Cubs. You know, those two teams have been 1-2 or 2-1 on any given day this year. And, you know, it's kind of what we expect it to be for the rest of the season. We're 2 months in now. I don't see either of those teams separating themselves from the other. I could be wrong. And, you know, the Pirates are acting a little frisky, too, making trades and trying to hang in there. And St. Louis, you know, still technically in there, too. And even the Reds are playing way better than they were earlier in the season. So it's going to be a very interesting Central Division these last 2 months, because the teams will be playing each other a lot as well.
Coming into the trade deadline, are there different philosophies based on where you are? Like, if your team is terrible, you're trading for next year or the year after. If you've got a shot this year, you are trying to get all the pieces you can for the home stretch.
And that's more or less how it works. It also, contracts have a lot to do with it. If you're a team that's not doing well and you have players who are going to be free agents after the season, and you'll probably lose them to free agency, best to get something for them now. That's how Joaquin Soria, the relief pitcher the Brewers got from the White Sox, and Mike Moustakas, the third baseman from Kansas City, they both were upcoming free agents, and so those teams weren't doing well. And so you either get something for them or you lose them to free agency and get nothing. So that motivates a lot of the trading this time of year.
Now, I understand a lot of national outlets were looking at the Brewers saying, hey, they needed an ace starting pitcher. And I assume there's no team that doesn't want another good starting pitcher. But did you see this as a particular need for the Brewers that went unfulfilled this time?
Well, you have to look at the market, too. You know, there was no C.C. Sabathia out there this year like the Brewers got in 2008, the player that kind of lifted them to the postseason. You know, The Cubs traded for Cole Hamels, but he's an older pitcher making a lot of money who wasn't doing well in Texas. And then the pitchers that the Brewers, you know, talked about before the trade deadline on Tuesday, Tampa Bay's Chris Archer and Baltimore's Kevin Gausman, those are nice pitchers, and they're signed beyond this year. But, you know, are they aces? No one would say they're an ace. You know, they both had ERAs well over four. And so you just got to see what's out there, too. And they're, you know, once the Mets made it clear that they weren't going to trade Jacob DeGrom or Noah Syndergaard, who probably are two of the best arms in the league, you know, then you have to decide what you're going to give up, too, Rob. I mean, everybody thinks the Pirates gave up a lot for Chris Archer. Were the Brewers willing to do that? Apparently not. You know, David Stearns, the Brewers general manager, did trade some of his prospects in this trading cycle. But remember, back to January, he traded a lot of their top prospects for Christian Yelich, who's been fantastic for them in the outfield. So you don't want to just wipe out your farm system, especially when you're a small market team like the Brewers, who needs to depend on their farm system. They can't go and spend gobs of money like the Cubs and Dodgers can on free agents. So they're always going to have to develop players from within. And so David Stearns tried to strike a balance of what he was willing to give up and what he really needed to improve his team. And they ended up going more for offense. And the Brewers have had trouble scoring runs at times this year. And so now this should make them a little more potent. Although they've got to find, you know, there's only four infield positions, and they've got like six guys now to fill them. So on any given day, somebody's going to be sitting on the bench.
Talking to Tom Hodrickort, Brewers beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, about this week's trade deadline, the moves the Brewers made getting ready to make their push to take first place in their division. Yeah, let's talk about those infielders. You mentioned Mike Moustakas at third base, and then there's this Jonathan Scope, a second baseman. Yeah, what do you do? They've got an excess of infielders now.
Yeah, and I think, you know, first base and shortstop are going to come into play, too, because some of these guys can play first, and Scope might be able to play a little short. So, you know, I think you're going to see Moustakas mostly at third base and Aguilar mostly at first base, but Shaw plays both of those positions as well, and they're playing him some at second base. Scope is mostly a second baseman, but I think you'll see him play some at short in place of Orlando Arcia, not as good a hitter as Scope is. So you've got all these interchangeable parts. Too bad they're not in the American League, where they have a DH. They could throw an extra bat in there every night. But you know, there's no such thing as having too many good players. And a lot of it, you'll see, some of these guys are left-handed hitters. You know, Shaw and Moustakas are left-handed hitters. Scope's a right-handed hitter. Arcia's a right-handed hitter. Aguilar's a right-handed hitter. So he can do, Craig Counsell will be able to do a lot of lefty-righty matchups. That'll determine a lot about who starts. But, you know, David Stearns made a pretty telling comment after the Scope trade. He said, we're going to ask some guys to make some sacrifices. There's going to have to be a commitment to winning. And that means looking past your own nose for what's best for the team, and accepting that you're not going to start every single game, that some nights you're going to start on the bench. But that doesn't mean you won't be in the game before the night's over. So there's that. You know, the better depth gives you a better bench.
Now, I think about some units in sports where you want chemistry. You want people who play together a lot, like an offensive line in football, or in football, a quarterback and their receivers. Is there such a thing as infield chemistry, where you want a group of players who are on the field who really know each other and where they're going to be?
I think sometimes you want that at short and second, because they combine on double plays a lot. But, you know, we're in an era of infield shifting now, where and the Brewers do it as much or more as any team, where they'll, with a right-handed pull hitter, they'll move everybody to the left side, and with a left-handed pull hitter, they'll move guys to the right side. And so the shortstop's not always playing on the left side of the bag. Sometimes the third baseman's over on the right side of the bag, too. So they move, and you'll notice with left-handed pull hitters, a lot of times there's a player playing in shallow right field, almost giving you two outfielders out there. So the game has changed so much as far as defensive positioning that we're muddled a little bit as to what a true second baseman and shortstop are, too. So we'll see how it works out. They may sacrifice some defense for this, but if they score more runs, they think it'll be better for the team. They have had trouble scoring runs at times this year, and pitching has carried the team. No one's going to deny that. So they're just trying to take some pressure off their pitching staff and score some more runs.
Let's talk about the pitching staff. Some injuries on the team. Any hopes of getting pitchers back into the rotation?
I think Zach Davies is getting closer. He's pitched so few games this year, I think less than 10 starts, because he's been hurt so much. We forget he won 17 games last year, which was one of the top numbers in the league, and that he was a very consistent pitcher for them prior to this season. So if they get him back, that's going to make them one more deeper, and with someone who has pitched successfully in the league, too. And then Jimmy Nelson, who hurt his shoulder very badly last September and had major surgery, they still hope he could maybe get back sometime in September. We're not sure if that's going to happen or not. If it did, that would give him a late boost on the mound. But it wouldn't surprise me if they don't find another way to pick up a pitcher if they need one. You can make trades after July 31st. The players just have to clear through waivers, so it's a little more complicated process and it's more difficult to do. But we'll see. The Astros picked up Justin Verlander last year on August 31st, and he ended up being the difference in them winning the World Series. So it's never too late to add a difference maker.
Now, Tom, you've watched a lot of Brewers teams over the years. The Brewers are doing well this year. Are they a fun team to watch?
They are, and they're an interesting team to watch because they have so many interesting stories. You know, Jesus Aguilar, who we call Babe Aguilar, just kind of came out of nowhere, you know, and all of a sudden made the All-Star team and was in Home Run Derby. Yelich and Kane are very high-level players. They have fun, but they're also very good players, and they've really added some juice to the offense and to their outfield defense. And so, and these guys have fun. If you see them in the dugout and in the clubhouse, you know, they're a tight-knit bunch, and I think they've added some more quality individuals, too, in Moustakas and Scope. So they do. They know how to have fun. They know how to draw the line and then make it business when it's time to play, too. So, but they're a very interesting team, a lot of interesting stories, and they certainly have given us lots to write about. They also make a lot of roster moves. Some of them have been necessitated by injuries this year, but they just kind of move guys on and off the roster to keep people fresh. And so we call it a good notebook team, Rob. They fill our notebooks up every day because they've got all these personnel moves going. So they definitely give us a lot to write about.
Well, Tom, thanks for sharing your notebook with us for today.
My pleasure, Rob. Anytime.
Tom Hodgecourt is a Brewers beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We talked with him about how the team is doing and about the various players the team picked up under the trade deadline earlier this week. It's time for Food Friday. Summer is in full swing, and it's a great time for cooking. There's a lot of great produce in season, and the weather is perfect for grilling. Our next guest has some advice for our summertime cooking. Don't be shy about the spices and other strong flavors. Floyd Cardoz is a chef, restaurateur, and the author of Flavor Walla, Big Flavor, Bold Spices, A New Way to Cook the Foods You Love. Floyd, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob, thanks for having me.
Well, I want to start out by thanking you because of the last time you were on, might use a little pinch of cilantro, I use a handful. Where I'd use a tablespoon of lemon, I use a whole lemon. I use the coffee grinder to grind up spices. I was shy about spices, and now I'm not. And that's kind of the goal of your book, right?
See, you know, what I find is very often we cook bland, uninteresting food, and then we wonder why our food's not tasty. And I believe that making food interesting with different spices, different flavors, different acids, different sweeteners makes us feel that our food is so exciting and we don't get palate fatigue. And my goal in life is to make sure that everybody doesn't get palate fatigue because I love to eat. I live to eat, and I want to eat. And I think everybody should have the same joy that I get when I cook and I eat. And I think it's very, very easy to do that.
Now, you write in your book, you've got a chapter on summertime cooking, and you have mixed feelings about summer because you're in New York City. You say a lot of your customers leave town this time of year. But on the upside, there's a lot of great, fresh, flavorful stuff out there.
You know, I'm also a home gardener, so at summertime, I get the best produce out of my garden. But in the Northeast, I'm sure it's, you know, like where you are, it gets really cold in the winter, and most things don't grow. So we get the best corn, we get the best tomatoes, we get the best cucumbers, the squash, the greens. I mean, the baby root vegetables like turnips and radishes. And I was in the market, you know, this morning, and I was so excited just to see everything. I want to bring everything to the restaurant and cook it, but like is normal in New York City, everybody leaves for the weekend.
Now, I get worried when I've got this great fresh produce out there. Like, I don't want to overpower it with spices and other flavors. I want to be able to taste it. Is there a way to get the best of both worlds this time of year?
It's fairly easy. What you have to remember is now is when everything grows. So if you go to your local grocery store and they got, if you live any part of the country, say in New Jersey, for instance, if they have asparagus from South America, do not eat asparagus. But if they have tomatoes, zucchini, onions, peaches, they have all these beautiful produce from the state itself. And you know that this has been picked a couple of days before. So if you go to your local farmer's market and they got corn, pick it up because they've grown it, they've cut it a day before, and it's got a lot of flavor. So you can add to it without taking away from what it tastes like, because as produce sits, it slowly loses some of its really great flavor it has.
We're talking to Floyd Cardoz, author of Flavor Walla, about adding a lot of spice and other flavors to our food, especially focused on summer. And, you know, Floyd, we're in Wisconsin here. We like to grill. You have a lot of grilling advice. Before we get to meat, you say veggies on the grill can be as good, maybe even better, than the burgers and brats and other things we're throwing on. Talk about some of your favorite veggies to grill.
So one of the things that I love to do, and I had some friends who said they hated broccoli. Now, a lot of people hate broccoli because we're used to going to these restaurants where broccoli is steamed and it's oversteamed and it's lost its crunch and beautiful texture and flavor that it has. So what I do to broccoli, or cauliflower for that matter, because cauliflower is in the same category, Brussels sprouts, cabbage, is I cut them into pieces that would grill really well on a grill, and I put them in a grill basket. I grill broccoli, I grill cauliflower, I grill cabbage. And Brussels sprouts, and it tastes so delicious. And what I like to do with these vegetables is, because they have a slight bitterness to them, I try to enhance and play off that bitterness. So I'll add a little bit of lime juice, I'll add a little bit of chili flakes, I will add maybe honey or maple syrup. So it kind of counterplays with all these flavors. And I grew up in India, and the food in India is all about playing these flavors off each other, because you don't want a dish that's only spicy or only salty or only bitter. You want a dish that has all these notes that, as you keep adding them, it makes it more interesting, and you just want to keep on eating it.
I worry on the grill, if I put the stuff on before, it's all going to drip away or cook away. But are you marinating the cauliflower and broccoli in that combo you just mentioned, or does it come into the late in the game?
No, what I do is, if I'm doing a meat with it, because these things cook pretty quickly, say if I'm doing a steak. Now, I grill the steak, and I can't cut into the steak right away because I want it to wait, because it has to rest. Because if I cut it right now, all the juice is going to go away. So I cook my steak, I let it rest. I have my veggies that I've seasoned with salt, a little bit of olive oil, a canola oil, a pepper and chili. I toss it, and I throw it in a grill basket. So while my steak is resting, I have this cooking. The other great part of these vegetables is that if you cook them just right and you cool them down right away, you can eat them cold. You can eat them room temperature, and you can eat them in a salad the next day. So what I do whenever I'm grilling at home, I always cook a little extra vegetables, onions, some turnips, zucchini, eggplant, corn, and I leave it for the next day, because then my wife can make a salad, you know, for her lunch.
That sounds fantastic. Or maybe later in the season, that sounds like it'd be a great addition to a soup.
Yeah, you could take all that and make a great soup with it too.
And now you've got a recipe you've shared with us. People can check this out at WPR.org/Food Friday. I'm going to stay on the grill for a minute here. It's a grilled pork loin with oranges and lemons. I think people think apple-type stuff with pork, maybe orange, lemon. That's a new one to me. Talk about this combo here.
So I love citrus. I think citrus fruit, incredible. They add a little bit of sweetness, a little bit of aroma. And using a combination of orange and lemon, and I use the slice of the fruit, and because I believe the zest has this oil that gives it a great flavor. And I think pork works really well with oranges. And making an orange glaze works really well. And I marinated with the oranges. I had cinnamon and clove. Now, a state where I come from is Goa in India, where we eat pork, and we almost always use cinnamon and clove with pork. So I grind cinnamon and clove. I add a little bit of ginger. Again, I think ginger works extremely well with pork and citrus. And bring it all together, marinated with paprika, peppercorns. And I found, too, that one of the curries that most people know about India is the pork vindaloo. And vindaloo has mustard in it. And if you look at traditional pork recipes, are always paired with mustard. So I put mustard in the marinade. I let it sit, and then I grill it. And the oranges, I love the bitterness of the oranges when you put them on the grill, and I never throw them out. So I always put them on top of the loin when I'm grilling it. And I love to bite on it because it gives it that little bit of sweetness, the acid, the orange, oranginess just kind of complements the pork and makes it kind of light and enjoyable for some.
That sounds fantastic. Again, we've got that at WPR.org/Food Friday. I mentioned earlier lemon. Actually, after I talked to you, I started doing this. I'll make a lentil soup, and I always like it okay. But after talking to you and you pitched lemon as a great flavor last time, I will just squeeze a whole lemon right at the end. After the soup's cooked and simmered for a while, I dump that lemon in, and it seems like it just brings everything else out in it. Is that a way you like to use lemon too?
I love doing that because it brightens it up. And we tend to sometimes use citrus fruits and just squeeze the juice and throw the rind away. Now, the other thing that you can do if you don't want that slight bitterness is you can zest the citrus fruit before you use it. Add the zest into the whatever you're making. It gives it another note. The way to make food exciting and full of flavor is to add notes of flavor that keep on hitting you at different points of your meal. That you say, like in this recipe, I also put rosemary. Pork and rosemary work well. So you have a bite, it's got rosemary, it's got a bite of ginger, it's got a bit of the orange. And that kind of makes it so much more interesting when you're eating it. The other thing that I do, and I'll give you another tip today, is we all buy limes at home and we all tend to not use them. And they sit in the fridge and then it's like, what do I do with this lime? It's old. So this is what I figured out. I take the limes that I have left over, and I normally like to buy the Mexican limes, the smaller ones, and I take them and I keep them on top of my water heater when I know I'm not going to use them.
Your water heater?
The water heater. They slowly dry out, and the next time I'm cooking pork or I'm cooking a meat stew, I take these limes, which turn kind of black on the inside, I crush them, and I throw them in. I hate wasting stuff.
It's black on the inside, but it hasn't gone bad.
It hasn't gone bad. It dries out, but the citrus, the whole thing gets really black on the inside, and it's absolutely delicious.
We're talking right now about summer cooking with some extra flavor. Our Food Friday guest is Floyd Cardoz. He's a chef, restaurateur, and author of the book Flavor Walla, Big Flavor, Bold Spices, A New Way to Cook the Foods You Love. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you incorporate spices and other strong flavors into your summer cooking? Is there a dish that you make that really pops, maybe with a pinch of cardamom or cumin or some of the acids we've been talking about, the lemon or lime or a vinegar you like? Do you have a question? Do you have that dish that you like? Okay, and it needs a little something. Floyd might be able to help you out. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. More conversation, more recipes coming up here on Central Time. Chef Floyd Cardoz is with us for Food Friday. He's adding some big, bold flavors to our summertime cooking, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite summer dish to make? Main dish, side dish. What is your favorite summertime produce to get into a meal, and how do you like to spice it up, or do you need some advice? You're making maybe a potato salad for a get-together, and it needs something. You don't know what. Floyd can help you out. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Floyd, I want to get into a couple more recipes you've shared with us. You mentioned seasonal produce. Tomatoes getting here right about now in Wisconsin. You've got an heirloom tomato salad. Talk about this dish.
So I love tomatoes. There was a point 1 year when I grew so many heirloom tomatoes at home that we were eating tomatoes every day, and my kids didn't want to eat tomatoes anymore. So heirloom tomatoes are one of summer's jewels, I believe. And whenever they come on, I just wait for the first one to come in. I eat the first one very simply with salt and pepper. But there's so many other things you can do with heirloom tomatoes. And I have a salad that I do, and the one in the book is where I take coriander seeds. I toast them. I take peppercorns and I toast them and I grind them, add some chili flakes, fresh ginger, serrano chilies. Now, I love chilies, and I got chilies in two kinds in this recipe because I believe a serrano chili has a different kind of heat than chili flakes, and different from pepper and different from ginger. And again, the same notes that I was talking about that I like to play with, you get a different kind of heat from each one of them. And black pepper has this aromatic flavor. And I believe that you should always use whole peppercorns and then crush them. And then, you know, I love to use Thai basil, but if you don't have Thai basil, you can use fresh basil. Italian basil works really, really well. Bush basil, I call for bush basil and Thai basil in this recipe. But the other thing that I learned from chef friends is that if you use mint with tomatoes, and most of us don't do that, mint works extremely well with tomatoes. So now every tomato dish I do, I add fresh mint in there. And in summer, mint glows really, really well. Extra virgin olive oil, balsamic vinegar. And I saw this ingredient in Italy, which is the very small flowers of fennel seeds. And they sell them in stores. And you sprinkle a little bit of the fennel pollen on top. And it just brings everything so well together. We are actually doing the same recipe on my menu at the Bombay Bread Bar in summer this year.
Can we use, if we don't have that fennel pollen, can we use fennel in some other form as a substitute?
You could definitely use regular fennel seeds. Or there's another interesting fennel that you could get from an Indian store if you have a store, spice store. It's called Lucknow fennel, which is a slightly smaller, more aromatic, more anise-flavored fennel. Now, if you don't get that, that's fine, but you can use regular fennel. And fennel is like this combination of coriander, black pepper, chili, and fennel is a very traditional spice mix that is used with a tomato curry in India that I've kind of adapted for the salad because I think they work so well together.
And you mentioned toasting the seeds. You've got peppercorns. You've talked about this with us in the past, cumin and coriander seeds. Talk about, A, how you toast them, and B, what we get out of it.
So I believe all spices have, and I know all spices have aromatic oils in them. And what you're trying to do when you're using them is you're trying to get these aromatic oils into the food. So you can either cook them in oil, or you can toast them. And you don't have to always toast them. I call, you know, cooking oil blooming it. But what I do is I take a skillet, which is medium to moderate heat, hot. I add the spice in, and I keep on shaking the pan. And when you do that, you make sure that your spice doesn't burn. And as this continues to cook in 5, 6, 7, 8 minutes, depending on the heat, you start getting this wonderful aroma. And what you're doing to the oils is you're making the spices a lot more palatable. So once you do that, you grind them, you cool them down, it changes the flavor. It gives it this nice, toasty, aromatic flavor to it that makes it so much nicer.
Talking to Floyd Cardoz, author of the book Flavor Walla, Big Flavor, Bold Spices, A New Way to Cook, The Foods You Love. We're focusing on great summertime dishes with some added extra flavor in them. You can find recipes, the ones he's talked about so far, at WPR.org/Food Friday. We've got grilled pork loin with oranges and lemons, an heirloom tomato salad, and this one, Floyd, you've got a recipe for a chimichurri sauce that sounds really good. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so about 8 years ago, I happened to go to Argentina for a food and wine festival to cook there. And when I was there, I had steak and they served me chimichurri sauce, and I'd never had chimichurri sauce before. And I was so excited by the sauce because it's kind of simple. It's not, you know, not a heavy, meaty sauce, but it was a very herbal, fresh oil and vinegar-based sauce that just, when added to the steak that I was eating, made it so much better. And over the years, I've kind of realized that, you know, you don't always need to have a heavy sauce. And when you're in summer and you're cooking outdoors and you want to have a sauce and you want to sit with your friends in your backyard and you just want to add a sauce that doesn't need to be heated up, it could be eaten at room temperature. And chimichurri sauce basically is a mix of herbs, oil, vinegar, and salt. And my chimichurri sauce has As I like black pepper and coriander, it's got black pepper and coriander in there. It's got vinegar in there. And I use sometimes champagne vinegar, sometimes red wine vinegar. It depends on what you like. And once I get all these sliced up and diced up, I have freshly picked herbs. And I don't like to chop them multiple times over the cutting board because I lose all the juice in there. I pick the herbs, I chop them up, and then I mix them in a bowl. Now, the trick with this is if I'm going to eat it within the hour, I'll add the vinegar to it, because what vinegar tends to do, it tends to discolor the sauce.
That thanks to Floyd Cardoz. That's all the time we have. He's the author of Flavor Walla. We've been talking about great summertime flavors and cooking. The race to unseat Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin has brought millions in outside campaign spending to Wisconsin. As part of WPR's series on candidates in the U.S. Senate race, Laurel White has this profile of Baldwin, who says she has the strategy to weather the political storm.
Tammy Baldwin is arguably the only person standing in the way of Wisconsin becoming a full-fledged red state. And she knows she has a pretty big target on her back. The string of losses for Wisconsin Democrats is long over the past several years, but Baldwin, who won her first race for Senate in 2012, is still here. But millions of dollars are flooding into the state to attempt to derail her reelection. The senator has made that outside spending a big part of her campaign, as she did at a rally with Bernie Sanders in Eau Claire last month.
Powerful special interests have already spent over $10 million to try to beat me. They are pouring in more money against me than any other Democratic senator up for re-election this year. But I have something these special interests don't. You!
Out of all the races on the ballot this year, no U.S. Senate race has seen more outside spending than Wisconsin's, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. Both sides have spent millions. But groups that support Republicans have outspent their Democratic counterparts 3-1. Barry Burden is the director of the Elections Research Center at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He says Republicans across the country are pouring money into the race because of Wisconsin's history as a swing state.
Wisconsin has veered back and forth, as we all know. Baldwin's only in her first term, and so looks like a Democrat who would be vulnerable. And the Senate is closely divided, and so every seat there matters to try to, for Republicans to build the majority somewhat.
Paul Maslin is a Democratic pollster and consultant. He says Baldwin has to win the support of at least some people who voted for Donald Trump in 2016.
She absolutely has to appeal to independents in the middle. You can lose a race by ignoring those votes.
Baldwin says she's met people who voted for her in 2012 and Trump in 2016. She thinks they voted for the president because they believed he would fight for people like them. She hopes they think the same of her.
I would say that if people are looking at that, who's their champion, who's fighting for them, that there's room for some, what we hope will be Baldwin in 2012. They were Trump, and then hopefully again Baldwin in 2018.
The Republicans vying to beat Baldwin, State Senator Leah Vukmir and former Marine Kevin Nicholson, say Baldwin is a far left-wing liberal who believes in unrealistic and irresponsible policies. They cite her support for the Sanders bill that would offer Medicare to everyone. Baldwin pushes back on that. She says she can identify as a progressive candidate and someone who's willing to compromise with Republicans. She reminds people that Wisconsin's progressive hero, Bob La Follette, was a Republican.
His frustration was that powerful interests had too much power in the Capitol in Madison and in Washington, D.C., and that the people needed more say.
Without a doubt, outside groups are spending a lot in Wisconsin, but so is Baldwin. She's raised more than $21 million this election cycle, which dwarfs both Nicholson and Vukmir. The stakes are high. Her race could decide which party controls the U.S. Senate. It could also say a lot about whether Wisconsin keeps its identity as a purple state. Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio.
For profiles of Republicans Kevin Nicholson and Leah Vukmir, visit WPR.org. And you can keep track of our ongoing series of interviews with candidates in contested primaries in statewide races and in congressional districts over at WisconsinVote.org. We always like a good story about animals showing up in unusual places here on Central Time. Usually we focus on Wisconsin, like the Kenosha County kangaroo from last year, the Grant County python that turned out to be a local bull snake, that kind of thing. But a story from Boise, Idaho today may be the greatest of all time. A local reporter posted video of goats showing up to pillage a local community. He tweeted, about 100 goats are on the loose right now in a Boise neighborhood. They're going house to house, eating everything in sight. Nobody has a clue where they came from. Updates to follow. Here's audio from the chaotic scene with sounds of panicked passersby.
That's the price you have to pay.
Okay.
Oh my God.
Yes.
So cute.
Okay, maybe not so much with the chaos and panic. It turned out the goats belonged to a local goat rental company called We Rent Goats. The goats had been working overnight in a drainage area, mowing, as only goats can, when they broke through a fence and headed to greener pastures, in this case in lawns and flower beds around the neighborhood. By 8:30 a.m. Boise time, We Rent Goats had arrived and corralled the goats. There were a lot of puns in the press after this. I will spare you. They were all bad. I'm sorry. I'm a bad person. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.